Hey Amarillo, I'm Jason Boyette, and you're listening to Hey Amarillo, the interview podcast featuring some of the most interesting people and stories of Amarillo, Texas. Today's episode is supported by Amarillo Habitat for Humanity's second annual Pickleball Bash, which is back by popular demand on May 4th. Register your team now for this doubles tournament at the Amarillo National Tennis Center. It benefits Amarillo Habitat for Humanity. The tournament includes two divisions. Division 1 is competitive for experienced players. Division 2 is a little bit more social for beginners and for fun. There won't be separate men's and women's divisions, so you can put your teams together any way you like. But both divisions have championship prizes for first and second place. This tournament fee is $100 per team. It includes double elimination play, a provided lunch, gift bags for every player, and a lot more. And of course, all proceeds go to support Amarillo Habitat, as the organization brings people together to build homes, communities, and hope here in Amarillo. Register your team at amarillohabitat.org before spots fill up. That's amarillohabitat.org, the second annual Pickleball Bash on May 4th. And as part of this podcast partnership with Brick & Ale Magazine, I want to give a podcast shout out to Leslie Massey Farmers Insurance, to realtor Francis Frost, and to Shimon Dental. Read the free e-edition of Brick & Elm's March-April issue at brickandelm.com, and stay tuned. We're sending our May-June issue, which is really exciting, sending it to the printer this week, in just a few days. Today's guest is Cindy Bulla. Now, I don't love interviewing politicians for this show, but I never mind talking to people after a local political campaign. And Cindy Bulla just ran in the Republican primary for Texas House District 87, which is a seat that's being vacated by Representative Ford Price, who was also a podcast guest a few months ago. Now, Cindy wasn't successful in her campaign. She ended up losing to Caroline Fairley in the primary. Fairley will run as a Republican in the general election in November. And while Cindy was new to politics, and we definitely talk about that, we talk about the campaign, she's not new to this area. She's been a realtor here for nearly two decades. She's the broker owner at Realty Central. She's an active local volunteer who has served in local and state capacities. She's a veteran Amarillo Little Theater performer who played one of the leads in the musical Always Patsy Cline, which literally put ALT on the map in the late 1990s. In which the theater brought back for a rave bonus run in 2021. I think you probably have heard of Cindy Bulla, but I want you to hear more from her in this conversation. Here's Cindy Bulla. Cindy Bulla, welcome to the Hey Amarillo podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Jason. I'm glad to be invited. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad to have you here. I know you're familiar with the podcast. Like we were saying, you're somebody I've wanted to talk to for several years on the show, and this feels like an opportune time, because a lot of things are happening and have happened that I want to get your perspective on. But I want to start with you the same way I start with all my guests and just ask why you're in Amarillo. So what brought you to this area in the first place?
I love to tell people that I'm in Amarillo on purpose.
Okay.
My career in real estate and my license in real estate would allow me to practice almost anywhere, but I'm here because I want to be here. I grew up in Plainview, and like most young people, I thought the first thing I wanted to do was get out of Plainview, get out of the panhandle, and I made my way to Austin, Texas. There's a whole story that goes with that. I actually ran away from home. At 15 years old, I snuck out my bedroom window, not really expecting to be gone forever, but turns out I was.
Wow, okay.
I ran away from home, got married. The thing I thought I wanted to do was just be a grown-up way too soon. I did end up staying married to that man. He's the father of my two daughters, and we were married for 7 years, and I had just a fascinating existence trying to make my way as a 15-year-old foolish person.
I can imagine.
But I made my way back to the panhandle shortly as a single mom. I had two little girls and got a job offer here with a savings and loan in early 1980s, like 82, 83. I can't remember the date. But
an auspicious time to be working at a savings and loan. Right?
Yes, they were crashing, which, by the way, is how I got probably the best career opportunity anyone could have ever had. So there was a woman here. I've lost track of her. Many of you may know her. Your listeners may know her. Her name was Margot Fields. And she had been working at the First National Bank of Amarillo, and they asked her to be the CEO of Palladura Savings and Loan, which they knew at the time was on a fast track toward receivership.
Okay.
It had participation loans, which turned into foreclosures on massive commercial projects all over the United States. So she reaches out to me. I had been a secretary at a savings and loan, and she reaches out to me and offers me the position of asset manager to work out all these big loan projects.
Okay.
And I explained to her promptly that I didn't know anything about it. And she said, well, they don't expect us to know anything. They just want somebody to go down with the ship. So she hired me, and the two of us together learned more about real estate over the next 4 years than
Wow.
you can even imagine. We traveled all over the United States, met with all these real estate moguls to try to dispose of all these assets, and were able to learn a lot during that time.
And you knew that, like, it was all crashing down at the point. Like, you weren't joining, you know, that job opportunity thinking, oh, this is a long-term career. You're like, I'm climbing onto a sinking ship.
Exactly. And I really didn't know. I knew that they were offering me what I thought was good money at the time. I look back on it, and it's kind of funny, but it afforded me an education like I could never have gotten any other way. So, and learning from this woman who, if you ask me to name a mentor today or someone who changed my world forever, Margot Fields is her name.
Okay.
And I don't know where she is. If I could find her, or if this podcast somehow touches her, that would be fantastic.
Maybe somebody who knows her is listening and
yes,
can point us in that direction.
So
that lasted 4 years?
Well, I was actually there for a total of 7 years.
Okay.
Margot cycled through and left before I did. I stayed through part of the receivership. And eventually, when all the assets were gone, I had worked my way out of a job. And there really was no more Palladura. It sold its what was left of its liabilities at the time were sold off to another bank. And so I moved on and did some freelance work with a local person. Bill Houday gave me an opportunity to do some freelance work for him. And then ultimately, I was hired by a local builder who also had a mortgage brokerage company and a real estate company. And that led me to get my licenses in all of those disciplines.
Okay.
And learned a lot about the building business. And then in 2006, I went out on my own and started Realty Central Services, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
Okay. So you were in the industry for several years, the real estate industry, before going out on your own. So what prompted you to think, okay, now instead of working for other people, I want to be my own boss here?
So through the entire time, it was a locally owned business that I was working for, and I always imagined, and the owner and I had always talked about that I would be able to buy or work into some sort of an equity position with, he had three companies. And, but as he approached retirement age, I began to realize that his children, even though they hadn't had interest before, really didn't. I mean, they wanted it in the family.
It's gonna be complicated.
I began to realize that there was not really a place for me. So I left and went out on my own, which was really the greatest thing that ever happened. I ended up opening in 2006, and then we know the big crash of 2008 came right after
that. It wasn't a great time to have opened a real estate company.
It did turn out to be a great time
okay.
for me, because I had cycled through all of those years where workouts were my forte. Understanding and knowing the complexities and what the banks were looking for in troubled assets. And it carved a niche for me that helped me work with a lot of builders that were trying to work out of their problems back then. Some of those builders are still in business today. And I feel like I was kind of very much part of the solution rather than the problem at the time. So I was able to do some workout deals with FDIC and with what was left of the Resolution Trust Corporation then. It allowed me to have a really good anchor in the business, even through the hardest times. And then when we had to work out, there were a lot of consumers or single family detached properties, like homeowners, that were in trouble at the time. And I was able to help them through short sales and some of the more complicated transactions for realtors back then. So that sort of made me flourish during a time when some of the other real estate firms were struggling a little bit.
Is that still sort of a niche that you have? I mean, there are a lot of real estate brokers in Amarillo. There's certainly a lot of agents. And one of the things I've always wondered is, You know, how do you distinguish yourself among this really competitive market? Is that one of the things that, maybe sets you apart?
It is. When the banking background and the workout background allowed me to know a lot about, like, we don't practice law in the real estate world,
right. but we deal with a lot of contracts.
We deal with a lot of contracts, and we can tell our clients, we can give them advice about what to ask their attorneys.
Okay.
And because of my insight, another name I'll drop from the old world that is John Oden. He's since mm-hmm. passed away, but what a great attorney he was and a great mentor to me. He worked with me extensively when I was at the savings and loan. And so I learned a lot about the questions to ask in the legal world when you're working on something or trying to get like title work worked out.
Right.
Those are things that gave me a leg up in more complicated, for example, higher end buyers that want to buy through LLCs or want to finance something different than your traditional 30-year fixed rate mortgage. I'm familiar enough with those products that I sort of became a go-to person for those people at the very high end or at that very entry level end that might need extra assistance or guidance when they're coming in. So having those two ends of the real estate world sort of nailed down and being a local expert in those things allowed me to really establish a good following with the very beginning of my business. And it's worked well for me ever since.
How have you seen the market change, the real estate market, the home markets? I mean, you've been at it long enough that you've been through multiple cycles. And so, like, where are we right now in this cycle?
So you hear old people say this all the time, and I count myself as one of those now.
So I can say this.
You hear people say history repeats itself,
mm-hmm.
and it does. What happened in the 80s, not long after we sort of cycled through that and saw things coming, we got into the early 90s, and I did a couple of magazine articles. One of the earliest articles I did was with the old Amarillo magazine, and mm-hmm. I think you had a relationship with them for a while. But I look back at that, and what I was warning against was overreacting to the 08 downturn.
Okay.
Because immediately what happens is everybody, certainly a lot of the media tends to go to the most salacious headlines.
Right,
so
right.
Everybody's predicting doom and gloom. And what I had learned when I cycled through those 80s and those really difficult years is that sometimes we create our own story.
Right.
We overproject, and it ends up being a sort of a self-prophecy. You all of a sudden you make it happen.
Right.
And in this article I looked back on, and I did so when we were going into 2020, because everybody, once the pandemic hit, the natural tendency is to say, everything's going to crash. It's going to be awful. And during 2020, I happened to be the chairman of the board of Texas Realtors. And so having that window, and I looked back at that article, and the article was like, don't overreact. We will force it to happen. It happened. I watched it happen. And then I saw it start happening again in 08. And so I'm warning everybody.
Yeah.
I'm running around going, I know you hear people say this all the time, but we're creating our own problems by overreacting to this. Stop with the headlines. And I think we saw some of that. I definitely think we did that. And then as we rolled into 2020 and the ferocity was, everybody turn off the spigot. We're all going to crash. We don't know what's going to happen. Turns out 2020 and especially 2021 set records beyond anything we had ever experienced for appreciation in real estate values and commitment and investment in real estate. Now, that created its own problem because
right.
it kind of created
the inventory crashed.
The inventory,
right.
Well, the inventory had begun to fall dramatically before COVID ever
okay.
happened. We did so locally, but especially as a state, because we had people migrating into our state for years before COVID happened. And then they doubled down on it after COVID because we were able to manage to find good balances
right,
between
right.
safety and staying open. And but it was crazy how all that, you watch it, and then you watch it happen again, and then you see it cycle through, and it starts to happen again. And you just want to scream from the rooftops, don't do it, don't
mm-hmm.
do it. Let it play out. You have to be realistic, but don't overreact, which is the tendency always.
Yeah, so much of what happens, and it's the real estate market, it's probably the stock market too. It's all narrative, driven by narrative and not necessarily the numbers. It's the stories we tell ourselves about the numbers.
Right. And more so now than ever because social media has sort of exacerbated every headline into even bigger than it is.
Do you find yourself, when you work with home sellers or home buyers, are you often in that position of trying to explain to them, to pull them away from the extremes and explain to them, this is actually the story. It's not the story you're hearing from either side. It's this place in the middle that the numbers are telling us.
And you know what? That is the value proposition of a real estate professional and specifically a realtor, which is a membership that I have. The value proposition there is really ingrained in being able to provide really strong data sets like trending and watching like minute by minute moves in the market and being very hyper local. And I think that's what I and the agents with whom I associate are able to bring to the table so much value. And that's why some of the trends, changes, and things that have happened in the marketplace with realtors in general, with the real estate profession in general, don't tend to really disrupt or scare those of us who know exactly what the value proposition is.
Okay.
Today, I work with consumers who are far more educated on what's out there. They don't need me to help them find a home because they have so many sources to look for
homes. It's easier than ever to find a home than it used to be.
They need hardcore professional advice that's based on facts at a price that is a good investment for them.
Okay.
Just like every other service they buy and every other thing they buy, product that they buy, they want it to be a good investment for a return to them. What they pay needs to be, it needs to be worth it by multiple times what they pay.
Okay. I guess the undercurrent of this part of the conversation is that there have been some major national changes with the National Association of Realtors and the percentage that is attached to the selling price of a home. And I think there's a lot of details we can get into that probably people won't care about, you know, unless this is not a real estate podcast. But I would like to hear from you as somebody who I know has an opinion about it and is very experienced, like what it might mean going forward. If somebody's looking to buy a home or sell a home, you know, now or 6 months from now, are they going to see any impact from those changes? Is it something that we're going to be aware of, or is it just something that real estate professionals are aware of?
I think the impact that the consumer will see will be their professionals being hyper-focused on describing what they offer and what their price is and exactly what that consumer can expect for that. There has been a consumer-facing sort of misnomer for many years that all realtors or all real estate professionals had a rate and they all charged the same rate.
It was just a flat rate. You can't negotiate around
it. And that was never true. But I am waking up to the reality that that was a perception. It wasn't my perception. And I tend to think that this happens with almost any service that we sell or any goods or products that we sell. The market will tend to find something that will be fairly common because there's a cost of doing business. There's a value sort of perceived or associated with experience and education. And then there is a rate that sort of finds itself based on what the consumer is willing to pay. And many of us, myself included, are waking up to the reality that there was, in fact, a very strong perception among the consumers out there that there was one price and we all charged it.
Right.
And I think the Department of Justice and some of the lawsuit, there was a lawsuit that was filed in a court in Missouri, and it was filed against the National Association of Realtors. And what they found is that because of the use of the multiple listing service, which is an extraordinarily valuable tool, you know, I said our consumers come to us now already equipped with, they know what's on the market. They've already done all their homework. Well, guess where all that homework came from? It came from a centralized database that was widely shared into whatever portal they were looking at. that was called the Multiple Listing Service. And I think there was a perception that the single use for that multiple listing service was to share information between brokers to other brokers saying, I will pay you X amount right. of my fee if you bring the buyer. And that was a tool for that. But the most important tool that was a centralized, documented, accurate resource for the same data that our consumers are using and that we're using to help inform like pricing strategies and trends that I was talking about. Those are valuable. If you are, whatever the number is you're spending on your real estate investment, you can make a 10, 20% mistake on that easily without accurate data that's properly analyzed. Mm-hmm. And so my concern about the future, and one of the things that I'm out doing as a leader of our industry, is saying, look, we may have lost that broker-to-broker sharing tool for how much we might be willing to pay a buyer's agent, but we didn't lose the tool itself, and it's the most important use, okay. both to us and the consumer. What I dread is if we start seeing a lot of real estate professionals say, well, then I don't need to put this information into a centralized right. database. I'll just save it for myself. And when you do that, then it's going to hurt consumers, and it's certainly going to hurt our value proposition to the industry. It may help it for those of us who keep good records anyway, but we'll only have our own. We'll only be able to verify our own, and through the MLS, we're able to do that. I know that's kind of into the weeds, but it's really important for people who plan to invest in real estate
right.
in a complicated market, and I think we have just that facing okay. us.
Tell me about that market. Like, what are some of the challenges right now facing the Amarillo housing market?
So the Amarillo housing market, number one challenge is still inventory. And I would say another challenge, and one of the reasons that I dipped my toe in some of the political discussions that we've had, I've sort of been in that narrative as an influencer and a person who works on the constituent side for a long time. But I feel like we're seeing a lot of governmental emphasis on doors, on housing, mm-hmm. but it's focused on doors, not ownership, but doors. And what I'm seeing are a lot of astute investors, and especially large, like mega investors, coming in and utilizing those tools that really weren't necessarily set up, those incentives from the federal and the state level that weren't really set up for use by mega investors. They mm-hmm. were set up to keep inventory coming on the market. And what we're seeing is a lot of inventory. In fact, I'm a little worried about the amount of inventory in the rental space, and almost no inventory coming on in the purchasing space.
Okay.
And what is unfortunately, and this is not the fault of the builders or developers, this is kind of the system, is creating a product that's more expensive than the workforce wages that might end up being in the buyer
right.
market.
Yeah.
And so the narrative I hope to shift is I want to get our governments, state, federal, and local, to the extent that they can, to start thinking about if they're going to incentivize inventory, mm-hmm. it needs to be for sale inventory.
Right.
It needs to be
not
opportunities
rental.
For people to become owners. We know from all of our research that one of the reasons I think Texas is such an attractive place to move is it's one of the states that remains predominantly owner-occupied, okay. although we're losing ground on that rapidly because of the affordability problem, which is directly tied to the inventory problem. But my hope is that we can refocus some of the energy and some of the incentives on creating inventory for sale to the public.
But that means building smaller houses, entry-level houses that are not going to be, you know, huge square footage or huge mm-hmm. number of bedrooms. And also that means lower profit margin for builders. And so sometimes you're having to build a large quantity of smaller homes instead of, you know, a smaller number of really big homes where you can make a lot of profit on. And so it's a change in the business model and the mindset for a lot of builders.
Mindset for sure, but mostly, Jason, of the consumer. So we're all used to, in Texas, our vision of that home that we're going to own has a great big yard full of green grass that has to be watered every day. And that's sort of what we think of when we think of home ownership. But in more urban areas, and let's face it, Amarillo's kind of going in that direction.
We've got some, yeah.
Yeah. In more urban areas, home ownership might look a little different. We're seeing, we've even got some platted properties out in the southwest Amarillo part of town that are going to be much, much smaller cottage type houses. Okay. Less so the tiny home thing, but very much on that line, down 1,200-1,300 square feet, smaller garage capacity. All of those things that we've come to expect in our single family homes are now, they're not really affordable for your working class. And when I say working class, I'm talking about our teachers and our firefighters and our police officers.
Well, anybody who doesn't have, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to drop on a down payment.
Exactly. So I think we're going to see an appetite grow for that. And some of the models that we're seeing are really fantastic. Also, the condominium, the townhouse. We have to start sort of embracing ownership opportunities that don't look like that tradition, partly because even at a municipal level, I sit on planning and zoning for the Amarillo, to the city of Amarillo. And at a municipal level, to keep our property taxes low, we can't afford to sprawl out another 100 square miles. We just, you think that the property taxes will offset that, but they don't, not even close. And so we have to start looking at downsizing what we think of as ownership. But that doesn't mean we have to give up ownership. Ownership is still critical, and it is the American dream. You can, anybody can survey that in almost any sector of society in any place, and home ownership is still right up there at the very top.
But at the same time, local developers have to allow space for that sort of model. Builders have to be willing to build it. And none of that's going to happen if the consumers aren't asking for it, if the demand's not there. And so there are a lot of factors that need to work in harmony to make that reality possible. And that's what makes it really complicated.
And I think we as realtors are having those conversations. I know there's some new zoning changes kind of on the table. They're out for public comment right now. The comments that I've heard as part of the Zoning Commission seem very positive about the way things are going and working more on Amarillo as it grows into a city. You know, we're right at the cusp, and we've been talking about it for years. But I think with the appetite for Texas and the congestion in those urban areas, our mid-sized cities, and Amarillo has done a wonderful job of putting itself in that conversation, our mid-sized cities are going to see some unprecedented growth. And with that comes this, I think the zoning changes that we're talking about are creating like small towns within towns, little enclaves and neighborhoods, and they're being a little bit more generous with the opportunities for small, like localized retail to be mixed into those neighborhoods so you can maybe walk to a restaurant or nothing to some of the narrative you hear out there is they're trying to keep us from getting outside our neighborhoods and all that. It's nothing like that at all.
No, but it's about livability, walkability, quality of life baked into the neighborhood and not just a grid
of
streets.
It's about safety and knowing your neighbors and being a small town even if you're in a bigger city. And Amarillo is in the perfect place. I get so excited talking about it. And this is one of the reasons I love Amarillo so much. It is in the perfect place to create those so that we're not isolating. We're just sort of making neighborhoods whole. Before you had to jump in your car and drive a few miles to get to those things that you consume every day, like a grocery store or a restaurant or a gym. And now we're seeing, we've been creating that through these homeowners associations and the planned developments that we have in Southwest Amarillo. And I think what you're going to see now is that model being created in Northeast Amarillo and that model being created in Southeast Amarillo and Northwest Amarillo, where I happen to live. And I'm really excited about it.
You touched on some of your involvement in politics, and I know that recently that's been a big part of your life. Mm-hmm. And if you want to talk about that, I'd like to hear a bit about your campaign. You ran in the Republican primary to replace Fort Price,
yes,
who is retiring as our state representative. It was ultimately an unsuccessful campaign, but I know that you see it as an opportunity for you to learn a lot about this area and to get some experience that really you're looking on positively, instead of like, oh, that's a disappointment, I wish that hadn't happened. That I'd like to hear a little bit about that for you, why you decided to run and sort of what that campaign was like.
Thanks for asking, Jason. So I had thought years ago about running for city, and I've done a lot of volunteer work for mm-hmm. the city and felt very capable and qualified.
But we've served on boards together.
Yeah, uh-huh. So for whatever reason, it just didn't seem like the right time or place. And I am, I'm really faith-driven, and I always feel like I'll know when I know. And I truly felt like when Ford made his announcement back in July, I was like, this is it. I've been sort of practicing for this role for my whole career. I'm ready. I have a lot to learn in the spaces outside the real estate space, mm-hmm. but I've been out there in all 8 of the District 87 counties. I'm ready to go. The hardest lesson I learned is that my name recognition and who I was and what I'd been doing in all those counties wasn't as recognizable as I thought.
Okay.
It wasn't associated with my name. It might have been associated with the Realtor Association, who I had represented as a leader for all those years, but my name wasn't out there. So I had more ground to make up than I thought I had to start with. The other thing, and this is the most exciting thing, I had to learn about all those other spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started with food supply, and you could do a whole other podcast on the exciting things I learned about the Panhandle and its commitment and its work ethic and its all the things that Panhandle people do every single day of their lives that feed the rest of the world,
yeah,
that nobody knows about.
Yeah.
I'd love to tell this story because one of the things I did was I scheduled to go to a meatpacking plant, and it was a Cavanaugh's brand, although we have multiple ones here. But I was like, okay, you're a candidate, you're a big girl, you've never done this, and you've never really looked forward to doing this. We're gonna suck it up and do it. So I worked up to this for a week, and I get there, and oh my gosh, I'm thinking I'm going to be a vegetarian forever after
yeah.
I go there. And what I see instead is technology mm-hmm. and precision. And I see it spaces that are like operating rooms. They're so sanitary and so careful. And the workers, the workers were so proud of their work. They were doing each of their individual jobs in these assembly places to precision and perfection. And you could, because they're all wearing masks, but you could see mm-hmm. in their eyes that they were so proud to show it to me. So I'm like, and the dairies, there's another whole story about that. The what we do as individuals, just because that's how we were raised. This is why I live here. These are the stories, the individuals, whether they're making whatever the entry level wage is, and it's much higher than you might think, by the way.
Yeah.
As an assembly line person at a meatpacking plant, or whether they're somebody like me, or whether they're somebody like the ultimate winner of that election, Caroline Fairley, everybody cares. We all care. The whole politics thing, mm-hmm. parts of it were really unseemly.
Yeah.
Not the other candidates. I worked with 4 candidates who were, for the most part, good people who I think were doing it for all the right reasons. But there were some of these third party.
Yeah, that kind of come in from other parts of the state.
Yeah, that come in. And some of the stuff that went out was just patently false.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to navigate that. Because you go out and you do these forums and you do these debates and you think we're giving them 4 good choices and that's all there is to it. But unfortunately, only a small group see that. the rest of them see these patently false narratives that go out. And I remember with my own strategy team saying, no, we're not going to do that. That's hateful. I'm not going to do that. No, we'll not do that. And they would say, but this is true. Well, but it's still, I don't want to go there. Let's make it about the best candidate, not the least of bad candidates.
Right.
And we the people are in charge of this, Jason. If I had any advice coming out of that, it is in the United States of America, the people are still in charge. But that comes with a lot of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go out and proactively know what the truths are, because you're not being told them
right
in your Twitter feed. You're not being told. You have to know what those truths are, and you have to know how the system works, and that's a responsibility. And I don't feel any bitterness at all, or at least I hope I don't. But I do feel like it's time for us all to double down. If we like being self-governed, then we had better take a bigger role in self-governance.
Yeah.
And it is absolutely terrifying what people are willing to believe and what other people, these big super PACs, can get away with putting in your mailbox.
Right.
Apparently, it doesn't have to be have even a morsel of truth.
Well, and when that much money is involved, mm-hmm. and then when it's being spent on a place like Amarillo, which mm-hmm. is a pretty low turnout mm-hmm. Voting area, especially for a primary election, mm-hmm. then it is really easy to sway an electorate that's not paying attention.
Far too easy. Far too easy. First of all, the people who didn't vote did.
By not voting.
By not voting.
Yeah.
That's a vote.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can say you're not interested in politics and it's too unseemly. And I agree with you. It's pretty hard to digest sometimes. But your non-vote is a vote.
Mm-hmm.
And so don't think that just by staying away, you've made some sort of a protest vote. You cast a ballot.
Yeah.
And we have people from my generation and people from your generation and people from every generation who have literally lost their lives preserving that right. We can get it together and make our decisions hyper-informed.
Yeah. Do you think your pursuit of politics is over? Is it a one-and-done sort of thing, or do you still have that itch to get involved?
Oh, I still have the itch. There's no doubt about it. In fact, maybe more now than ever. But I see a career window, and at 64, I felt like I was getting close to the end of it. You need to feel like you can serve at least two or three terms, and at two years apiece, that's 6 years.
You don't want to just be running for office
right.
18 months after you get the job.
And if I knew that in 6 years I would have the same level of stamina and energy and, frankly, passion and mm-hmm. excitement about it that I do now, which I felt like going in, I would. Will I in 2 years? Maybe not. And if Caroline does a great job, what I'm going to want to do is support the best person for the role. And if that's her, I'm going to be wanting to support her. And for all of our sakes, I hope it is. I'll be just like I was with Four. I never had any inkling to run against Four because I felt like he was doing a great job for the Panhandle. So I'll do the same thing with Caroline. What we're looking for right now is the best representative for our area. And right now, all of my neighbors who voted for Caroline Fairley think she's the one. And I'm going to choose to believe that they're right.
Okay. I'd like to pivot just briefly here at the end and ask you about something else. I know that despite all the things you're involved with and a really busy career and volunteer stuff, you've also been very involved with Amarillo Little Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And have had a really impressive career, especially in the 90s and early 2000s, with Always Patsy Cline, and worked closely with Alan Shankles. We're recording this about a week after he passed away, and I wonder if you could tell me just a little bit about your relationship with ALT and the impact that he had, because he had become such a prominent figure in the community, in the arts community, and you're involved with that in so many ways. Talk a little bit about that.
So the interesting thing about, let me tell you a story about my very first opportunity at Amarillo Little Theater. Alan was still fairly new. I don't remember what year it was, but there was an audition for A Streetcar Named Desire. And I had just moved back to Amarillo, hadn't been here all that long, well, maybe a few years, but single mom, two girls that were in school. I was trying to raise them on my own. And I was just out of a long relationship, which was the second, like, it's forever relationship in my life, and feeling really lost. And someone suggested that I go audition. And so I remember saying, oh, community theaters don't let new people, you know, they don't embrace new people. It's a clique.
And yeah, it's all the same people.
It's all the same people and all that. And someone said, well, just go audition. You need the time away. You used to do theater. And I had done it like a little bit in high school. And when I say high school, I mean my freshman year, because remember, I ran away after
that. So, at Plainview, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I go there and I'm living this Tennessee Williams story anyway, because I'm just a mess. Emotionally, I'm a mess. And I auditioned for the role of Blanche DuBois.
Okay.
And Alan was playing Stanley. He'd been precast as Stanley Kowalski. So those were the two leads. And the guy that was directing it and casting it was from WT. He'd been an old professor of Alan's at WT. So he casts me in the role of Blanche DuBois. And all of those old acting chops, which come kind of naturally to me, came back. And Alan and I were, I mean, if I do say so myself, we were pretty well a hit. And we created with the fellow cast members and all of Alan's artistic influence on the show from outside his role, made for one of the best shows I think ALT had had in a long time. And it sort of launched a series of great dramatic efforts there. But I will tell you that on opening night, we had rehearsed a curtain call. You always rehearse the curtain call. And this will tell you a lot about Alan. So Alan's the big daddy. He's calling all the shots. He's there. And the curtain call has been blocked for him to go last. And I don't know that much about theater. I don't know that sort of implies the last curtain call is kind of
the
big wig. And so just before curtain call on opening night, he says to me, no, I'm going before you. You're going last. And I'm thinking, okay. Because in my mind,
you thought
I'm
he wanted
thinking,
to go first.
Yeah, he wants to go first. And it was quite a while after that that I realized the gift he had given me on opening night that he sandbagged until then. He didn't tell me he was going to do that. He didn't tell the director he was going to do that. That's Alan.
Yeah.
You can think, even now, there's people who think, oh, that guy must have been rough. He was hard. And he was. Mm-hmm. But he was exactly what ALT needed. And there was a soft spot in the middle that I don't think a lot of people know about, but it was there. And it was beautiful. And he was something incredibly special. And not just me. See, I'm getting kind of teary. Yeah. Not just me, but everybody who has worked with him probably has a horror story. But they also, most of us will tell you, he changed our lives. He made us a little less sensitive. We didn't wear our feelings on our shoulders as like some artists do. Mm-hmm. But he made me a different person. And I think most of the success that I have experienced in my lifetime, especially on the public side, I owe to the things that Alan Schenkels taught me and working in a little theater taught me for all those years that I did. It is a beautiful place. And now I see, it has a memorial service, Jason. I saw adults who were children when I was there sitting. I saw Patrick sitting on the edge of the stage singing the song from Big River.
That was the most profound moment I've had in a memorial service in a long time, having seen those two guys do that musical 20 plus years ago, and then coming to sing that song again as grownups was astounding.
And then I had a conversation with Patrick afterwards, and his life is at sort of some crossroads.
Yeah.
And what it meant to him to sit there. Oh, I mean, and it all goes back to the broader panhandle and the the story we have to tell, sometimes we let other people tell it for us, but we need to be, those of us who lived it, we need to be experiencing it. And it's all tangled up in the politics and the professionalism and the arts and the acceptance and the inclusivity and the definition of conservative that I kept repeating. Conservative means less government. It means less involvement in your personal life. It means living and letting other people live theirs and not trying to micromanage that, but just being neighborhoods. And none of that is way to the right or way to the left. It's all mixed in. And it's why I thought politics was a great space for someone who's lived the conservative path and defined it as less government, more personal responsibility, more personal autonomy. And all of those things, when you start mixing them all in together, they sound like passion, and they sound like beauty, and they sound like health. And I want that to be that. I think that's what America is. I think it's what it was intended to be. I mean, I know I'm going off here, but I'm just telling you, it's really beautiful when you let it just happen. There doesn't have to be hate to be difference.
Yeah.
It can all coexist in a really beautiful way. And I want us all to speak up and say that.
Today's episode is supported by Pinnacle by Rockrose, a new master-planned neighborhood being developed at Hollywood and Bell, south of Randall High School. The 2024 Parade of Homes is coming up, and three Pinnacle homes will be on display for this event, April 25th to 28th and May 2nd to 5th. All of these homes are on Stonecrest Drive in the Pinnacle development, so you can literally walk from one home to the next. Look for a four-bedroom home by Cornerstone Fine Homes at 9502 Stonecrest, another four-bedroom by Johnston Homes at 9504 Stonecrest, and a four-bedroom home by Connolly Construction at 9506 Stonecrest. Parade of Homes tickets are available now for $10 for ages 12 and up. You can get them at Pack-A-Sack, United Supermarkets, and on the Parade Smart app. To learn more, visit pinnaclebyrockrose.com or amarilloparadeofhomes.com. This episode of Hey Amarillo is also supported by Lazy Boy Home Furnishings. You know Lazy Boy is a national brand, but its Amarillo store is independently owned and operated by the Hawkins family. They live right here in the area. And here's the thing, Lazy Boy offers a lot more than just the recliners you're probably thinking about. Amarillo's locally owned Lazy Boy Home Furnishings has a ton of products in stock, ready to take home or deliver today. So go visit the showroom at 3636 Sonsi. That's Lazy Boy of Amarillo at 3636 Sonsi. Okay, I'm back with Cindy Bulla. Cindy, this is the part of the show I call 8 Straight. 8 Straight is sponsored every week by Panhandle Plains Historical Museum in Canyon. It's the largest history museum in Texas, and its collection, I chose this for you, its collection includes everything from an exhibit about the mud homes of the Antelope Creek people to the two-room log cabin headquarters of the historic T. Anchor Ranch, which dates back to 1877, to the windows from a 1915 kit house. So there's a whole lot of old homesteading and how to live in places like the Panhandle that you can discover there at the museum. You can see those exhibits or learn more at panhandleplains.org. Okay, when you think of Amarillo 10 years from now, what do you hope for?
What I think of Amarillo 10 years from now and what I hope to see is that we've continued to grow, because you got to grow. You can't not grow. You can't shrink and you can't stay stagnant. You have to grow. But I want us to grow in a way that will keep that small town feel. Right now, I see Amarillo as the biggest small town in Texas. Mm-hmm. And I think what will do that are some of the things that I've been so focused on for the last few years, like creating these little neighborhoods and working on the zoning changes that will help us create neighborhoods within the city so that it'll always feel like a community and we'll always feel that sense of community that caused people to settle here. I want us to hold on to our heritage, but I also want all of our cultural things, all of our educational things to continue to be robust and grow and move with the times. And I think we do that pretty well, but we've got to make that happen exponentially in the next 10 years.
Okay. Other than wind, what does this area have too much of?
Too much misinformation about our lore. We do love our heritage and our culture, but I think I mentioned this earlier, sometimes we let other people tell our story. Mm-hmm. It's not all about the boots and jeans, although we love them, we wear them, and we celebrate them. But we're letting too many other people define us as a small piece of a big place called West Texas. Okay. And I want people to know what we're really about. We're a city, and we've got tremendous opportunities in these cities. And I know this, I get reminded all the time when I pick up people from the airport who are being transferred here, and they're like, oh no, we're being transferred here. And I get to tell that story because I love that story, and I love what it really is, not what other people are telling about. And I want other people to get on that bandwagon.
Okay. What does this area not have enough of?
Doesn't seem like it has enough of those people who have dispersed, because a lot of our young people have dispersed out around the country. Mm-hmm. I want them to honor their roots. We don't have enough of that. And maybe it's because we're not reminding them, even if they choose not to come back. And by the way, a lot of them are choosing to come back for those very reasons. But I want them to understand that some of the value systems that are being appreciated by their employers and their clients and the people that they are influencing now, some of those value systems are rooted in the culture that they gleaned right here in the Panhandle. I want those stories to be told. I'm afraid our narratives are being hijacked.
Okay. I can see that, especially if you have people who are leaving town and thinking, I'm getting out of that place, you know? And so they don't realize how much they've been shaped by Amarillo because they're trying to leave it behind.
Sure.
And then not realizing that they're not really going to leave it behind as much as they think so because of the good things that living here has implanted in their personality, their work ethic, their talent.
Sure. When other people think of Amarillo, they often think of weather or they think of I-40. And we are those things. We have four seasons, and sometimes we love them and sometimes we hate them, but we have four, and a lot of us choose to live here because we like all four of them. But yeah, we have to tell the whole story, not just the wind or the ice storm that stranded us here for a week, but the whole story. What did the people do during the ice storm?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, what's your favorite local coffee shop?
It's Palace, no question. I have loved the people since they opened it, and I still love the atmosphere. I love that the 34th Street space has a neon sign that the first thing you see when you walk in is "Be kind." Mm-hmm. I love that.
Also, a very close connection to ALT.
Yes, too, why I tried it to start with.
What's your favorite local restaurant or food truck?
So, and this is recent, and I'm sorry, Tyler's, I love you, but Nine Line Barbecue is the business. If you haven't eaten there,
I have not eaten there.
Try it.
Okay,
it's crazy. I first came in contact with it as a food truck. Never heard of it. Turns out that the guy that owns it is a friend of my husband's, formerly from Pantex, the Guard Force. But oh man, very different and incredibly delicious.
Okay. Yeah. That sounds like a good endorsement. Yeah. All right. What's the most underrated thing about Amarillo?
I would say its sense of community. It is just, people don't realize how close-knit we are, how frequently we see people that we know at the grocery store. We really are a community-driven society, and that's from our heritage. It's from our roots, and we seek it out. We do it on purpose. And I don't think everywhere, especially cities of our size, do that anymore like they really should, and I think we need to seek that out more.
Was that something you had to be aware of running for office, that you can't just pop into Market Street at any time of night in your sweats, that you had to think, I am likely going to see somebody who knows me or who recognizes me. And so you feel like you've always got to be on, in a sense like that.
So I've always been somewhat public in my persona with the real estate business. So I've always kind of had that sense that you're almost never going to show up somewhere without makeup, that you don't run into somebody you know. And I think that's one of the things that comes with my age. I'm like, well, this is me. But yeah, it's true. We do know more people than we think we know.
What's your favorite neighborhood in Amarillo? And this this may be a hard thing to ask someone who's in the real estate business, but is there one that maybe you find the most charming or the most attractive to you?
Well, I mean, this probably happens with a lot of the people that answer this question. It's mine. I moved to Westcliff in the early 90s.
Okay.
And it seemed like it was so far from town. It was up in the Northwest.
Right.
Oh, my husband and I, because I'm in the real estate business and I see all these opportunities, we've talked about moving dozens of times. We live in a house that's way too big for a couple of empty nesters, but it is so beautiful out there. And we have this sense of community. We know our neighbors. We know so that's my favorite. And I've watched its iterations. I was involved in the development out there. Mm-hmm. It's what took me out there in the first place. And so that has to be my favorite. But what I would say is that every neighborhood in Amarillo, and I could describe them all, I think, has its own character and its own little following. And that's one of the really beautiful things about Amarillo. It's one of the things I hope to preserve about Amarillo.
Okay. All right, last question. When was the last time you visited the Big Texan?
It's been probably within the last 18 months.
Okay.
But I have to say it was taking a touristy person that was here to visit me there because that was their tourist stop. It is a wonderful cultural icon for us. But maybe proximity, I don't know why. I don't think to just go there for dinner.
It's not very close to Westcliff for dinner.
And fun fact, I used to work there.
Did you really?
It was associated with the theater, but there was a melodrama, all of this, back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the hostess and the madam and the lead character for the melodrama for several summers out there. So I worked there and got to know Bobby and all the gang out there.
Okay.
It was a fun time. And what it does for us culturally and the number of people from other countries who visit there every year is staggering.
Yeah, it's astonishing. Mm-hmm. Okay, that concludes all my 8 straight questions. Cindy, I like to close by asking my guests to endorse something. So what's one thing you would like listeners to know about or to experience?
So it's all of the arts scene in Amarillo. We have to support it. We have to love it. We have to give of our time. We have to give of our talent and especially of our resources. And we've had a lot of old families and trusts that have been set up and vehicles that have been set up to help them financially. But we have to do two things. We have to go. We have to buy tickets and go to their showings and their viewings and their galleries and their performances. We have to be present. We have to love them. And then we have to give. And obviously at the top of that list for me is the Amarillo Little Theater. It has done so much for us on levels so far beyond just the arts itself and just the shows they produce. Go to those shows, see them, buy tickets, buy memberships, do that for the opera, do it for the symphony, do it for all of our arts entities. It's so important.
Okay. That's a great endorsement. Cindy Bulla, thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And that concludes the episode. You can find out more about Cindy Bulla and her company at RealtyCentralAmarillo.com. Thanks to the Habitat for Humanity Pickleball Bash, to Pinnacle by Rock Rose, Lazy Boy Home Furnishings, and Panhandle Plains Historical Museum for supporting this podcast. Thanks also to Angelina Marie for editing this show. I messed up so many times trying to deliver this information here, so she did a good job if you didn't notice. Thank you for listening. I really do appreciate it. Hey Amarillo exists on a weekly basis because of listeners like you and the local people who support it financially through patreon.com/heyamarillo. Hey Amarillo's executive producers include Corey Burns, Katie Linger, Jason Burr, Patrick Burns, Barbara and Jim Witten, Wes Reeves, Cindy Graham, and Josh Wood. This has been episode 349. I'm almost to 350, and it seems like my 300th episode was just a few weeks ago. So time flies. Anyway, my name is Jason Boyette, and I'll see you next week.